It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Israel and Hamas agree on humanitarian ceasefire, and investigators reach Ukraine crash site as EU adopts Russian sanctions. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. The United States and United Nations have announced that Israel and Hamas have agreed on an unconditional 72-hour humanitarian ceasefire. Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary General Ban Ki-moon say the truce is set to begin this hour and will be used to give civilians in Gaza a much-needed reprieve from violence.
And neither side will advance beyond its current locations. They will stay where they are in place. Israel will be able to continue its defensive operations for those tunnels that are behind its lines. And the Palestinians will be able to receive food, medicine, and additional humanitarian assistance, as well as to be able to tend to their wounded, bury their dead, be able to, in safe areas, travel to their homes, and take advantage of the absence, hopefully, of violence.
As soon as the truce takes effect, Israeli and Palestinian delegations will head to Cairo for talks on a longer-term ceasefire. Investigators in eastern Ukraine reached the wreckage of a downed Malaysian airliner Thursday. It was their first look at the July 17th crash site after earlier attempts were blocked by armed pro-Russian rebels. The one-hour survey of the wreckage near the Russian border came as artillery shells exploded in a nearby village. Alexander Hug, deputy head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe delegation, said the four investigators would return to the site today to search for human remains and belongings. Ukraine and Western governments blame rebels for the shootdown. U.S. analysts say the jetliner with 298 people on board was likely downed by pro-Russian separatists firing a Russian missile. There were no survivors. An American aid worker who became sick with the Ebola virus in West Africa is returning to the United States within the next several days. Hospital officials at Emory University confirmed the patient would be treated in a special isolation unit there, but declined to identify the person. The University Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, has one of only four such facilities in the United States and has worked with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, to set up the special unit. Earlier Thursday, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the State Department was working with the CDC to facilitate options to bring home infected U.S. aid workers. The largest known outbreak of the lethal Ebola virus in West Africa is prompting authorities as far away as Asia to take preventative measures, although scientists say a global spread of the disease is unlikely. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
At South Korea's Incheon International Airport, a major hub for air travel in Asia, quarantine inspections of arriving passengers are being enhanced. Authorities say all passengers are being recorded by an infrared camera to detect fevers. South Korea's foreign ministry spokesperson Han Hye-jin says this is being done because Ebola is becoming a big concern. She says the South Korean government, in association with health authorities, is paying attention and carefully determining if additional measures are needed. The country's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it established an Ebola task force in April and is prepared for possible infections in South Korea. It is also urging South Koreans not to visit the affected African countries. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
A series of massive gas explosions ripped through Taiwan's port city of Kaohsiung late Thursday, killing at least 24 people and injuring more than 200 others. Taiwan's premier said at least five explosions shook the city of 2.8 million residents and that hundreds of soldiers were helping in rescue efforts. Taipei's central news agency said the cause was not immediately confirmed as search and rescue efforts continued earlier today. From Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, the first day of August, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ebola affected West African countries. Meet today in Guinea-Conakry.
The three presidents will meet and then discuss and have an harmonized decision on how to fight best against Ebola so that they can have concerted measures.
Mustafa Naite is Guinea's Minister for Youth Employment. The United States urges non-essential travels to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. South Africa's land reforms prove contentious 20 years after the end of apartheid. And Nigeria aims to transform its agricultural sector.
And so the economy needs buffers. And agriculture is what we've always done. We had agriculture before we had oil. So we can just basically return back to basics, which is do agriculture and unlock wealth. But a different kind of agriculture.
Akinwumi Adesina is Nigeria's agriculture minister. Zimbabwe urges its local communities to help revamp the country's health sector. And an American man proclaims a new nation in Africa and make his daughter the princess. Those stories plus Mark Overman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Three West African countries hard hit by the Ebola epidemic are meeting today, Friday, at an extraordinary summit in Guinea's capital, Conakry. This comes as the World Health Organization has announced a $100 million response plan to combat the unprecedented level of the outbreak. The WHO also says that the number of cases has risen to 1,323 with 729 deaths. Guinea's Minister for Youth Employment, Mustafa Naite, says President Alpha Conde of Guinea, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, and Ernest Bai Koroman of Sierra Leone will discuss how best that they can coordinate a sub-regional response to the epidemic.
The three presidents will meet and then discuss and have an harmonized decision on how to fight best against Ebola so that they can have concerted measures so that one country cannot just move by itself. The three countries will have a strategized and proposed way of fighting against this disease.
The Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on Wednesday announced new measures how to deal with the Ebola outbreak in her country or in the region, including even closing Liberia's borders with Guinea and Sierra Leone. What steps have your government taken to control the further spread of the Ebola virus?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why this summit is being held, so that they can have a harmonized decision and harmonized measures taken from one country to the other one. It would not be efficient for one country to just have its measures applied. It should be a regionalized strategy so that we can stop this outbreak.
The World Health Organization on Thursday announced that the number of confirmed Ebola cases has grown to 1,323 with about 729 dead. I know the virus started in your country. How is it now? Are you seeing declining number of cases or is still going high?
It's been declining for a very long time now, and we've been in that process. I don't want to go into details about how the spread started and how when it goes down and then when it gets started. The most important thing that one should remember now is that once we harmonize the efforts and once we are together to fight the disease, then the outspread will be best controlled because the center that deals with it in Guinea will be in close tight and contact with the other centers in the other two countries. I would like to announce to you as well that the director for World Health is already here. They announced the $100 million support to fight against this disease.
The leaders of Sierra Leone and Liberia have canceled their trips to the United States, where the U.S.-Africa summit is supposed to begin next week. Is your president, Alpha Conde, coming to the United States?
As far as I know, we had an extraordinary cabinet meeting of all the ministers yesterday, and unanimously we urged the president to participate in this summit because they're going to be talking about the future of Africa. It's not every day that the African presidents and world leaders will meet to discuss how to best strategize and how to best deal with the next generation that will be leading Africa. So it's a very, very important meeting.
Mustapha Naite is Guinea's Minister for Youth Employment. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. U.S. health officials are urging Americans to avoid non-essential travel to the three West African countries facing an Ebola outbreak. As Faith Lapidus reports, additional experts are being sent to the area to help the governments of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea manage the crisis.
Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, addressed what he called the biggest and most complex Ebola outbreak in history, centered along the common border of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
Over the next 30 days, we plan to send an additional 50 CDC disease control specialists into the three countries. These individuals will help countries establish emergency operations centers that can develop a structured and effective way of addressing the outbreak. This is being done in close collaboration with the World Health Organization. They will also help strengthen laboratory networks so testing for the disease can be done rapidly. And third, building the capacity of individuals from within the area to do these functions for this outbreak and future threats as well.
He identified two major challenges those governments face in trying to control the situation.
Many of the health systems in these countries are not highly functional. They may not reach into rural areas, healthcare workers may not reliably be present at facilities, and facilities may have very limited capacities. Second, in some areas, there has been lack of understanding and hostility or violence against some of the groups that are trying to respond to the outbreaks.
Among the CDC experts headed to the region will be airport screeners to help countries identify travelers who may be sick. Frieden also announced a more urgent travel alert, advising Americans to avoid any non-essential trips to the area. He reviewed three key steps to stop the outbreak: rapidly identifying and isolating patients, finding and following anyone they had contact with over the previous 3 weeks to see if they developed symptoms, providing supportive care and treatment centers, and preventing future cases through education, strict adherence to quarantine protocols, and avoiding the consumption of bushmeat and bats. Frieden concluded, "This is a marathon, not a sprint," warning it will take 3 to 6 months to get the situation under control. Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria's government says it wants to wean the country from years of overdependence on oil production by transforming the agricultural sector into the cornerstone of the economy. Agriculture Minister Akinwumi Adesina says a lack of leadership and political will by successive governments led to the neglect of the agricultural sector. But he tells reporter Peter Clotty that the Goodluck Jonathan administration has implemented measures to transform agricultural production.
So the objective is to use agriculture as a wealth creator, right? To diversify the economy, to create wealth, and to create a lot of jobs. Now, obviously, Nigeria's economy is known for oil and gas, but we know that because of volatility in global commodity prices, that means that we are, exposed to these volatilities. And so the economy needs buffers, and agriculture is what we've always done. We had agriculture before we had oil. So we can just basically return back to basics, which is do agriculture and unlock wealth, but a different kind of agriculture. An agriculture that is modern, an agriculture that is more commercial, market-oriented, an agriculture that is seen not as a way of, let me say, managing poverty, no. Agriculture is not a social sector, but we decided to take agriculture as a straight-line business so that people that are in the rural space can actually have a lot of wealth unlocked for them.
For those who are in West Africa, they've always known Nigeria to be potentially the breadbasket of not only West Africa, but, could be continent-wise. What happened that, it appeared that it's only gas and petroleum and agriculture is relegated to the background?
Well, it's a classic problem that you find almost in various parts of the world that when people discover, oil. And so the first decision that I had to take, and with the president's, expert support, was to clean up that mess. And we did. We cleaned up a corruption of 40 years under his president. It took us 90 days to do exactly that. We took the government out of buying and selling fertilizers and seeds. We launched a program in which the private sector, which is the engine of growth anyway, you know, because I don't believe that the role of government is to produce stuff. You know, the role of government is to do good policies and good institutions, good regulations, and public good infrastructure, and then let the private sector, the engine of growth, drive it, and then we started.
People that I have spoken with in Nigeria seem to express concern about the heavy importation of food crops, including rice. And they say, literally, anything can grow in Nigeria. So why import so much when less than 10% of the land is being used to cultivate stuff?
You know, we were spending $11 billion importing basic things like wheat, rice, you know, fish and sugar. Now, for crying out loud, all those things we can produce in Nigeria and do very well with it. And so we took a good look at it and we said, we've got to tackle this huge food import bill and pick the case of rice. And so we started in end of 2011, a strategy approved by the president to make Nigeria self-sufficient in rice production by 2015.
Akinwumi Adesina is Nigeria's agriculture minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the first day of August. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. 20 years after the end of apartheid, land issues remain as contentious in South Africa as they ever have. Activists argue that the pace of land reform is slow and biased, while legal experts are scratching their heads about how some proposed reforms will be implemented. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Land reform is a prickly issue in South Africa. For some, it conjures up images of land being stolen from black people under apartheid. For others, mainly whites, it incites fear of being evicted from their farms, echoing Zimbabwe's forceful approach. Today, most of South Africa's most fertile land is still in the hands of a few thousand white commercial farmers. The government now wants to buy land from those owners and redistribute it to black people who were forced off it during white minority rule. The Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill became law on July 1st. The law reopens a claims process that ended in 1998 and gives people who were forcibly moved from their land 5 years to lodge new claims. If claimants are successful, they are given the option of getting their land back or receiving financial compensation. Nomfundo Gobodo, who is the country's chief land claims commissioner, says the law is necessary.
And you find that people's wounds have not yet healed. You know, they still remember the stories where people say, I went to school and I came back, we didn't have a home. You know, so it's really about giving back people's dignity.
However, the process is fraught with problems. Some experts argue that there is a lack of capital to sustain farms under new ownership, and that many black farmers who would win land claims do not have the skills to keep the farms commercially viable. More than 5,000 claims have been lodged in the first month. The majority, Gobodo says, are opting to take cash payment over having their land back. But she warns that this short-term win won't break down inequality and poverty for future generations. The government has made big promises, but less than 10% of white-owned land has been handed over since 1994. Out of the nearly 80,000 land claims submitted during the 1990s, 8,000 still have not been settled due to protracted legal battles. Corruption could also taint the process, as politically connected traditional authorities try to push through large land claims. The better off may reap the rewards of a scheme originally designed to reduce poverty and inequality, says Ruth Hall, an associate professor at the Institute of Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies. Whichever way the debate turns, it is clear that South Africa's land issues are far from over. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's health minister has urged the local communities to work closely with industry, commerce and other stakeholders in helping government revamp the health sector devastated over the years by the country's declining economy. Reporter Toraya Shava of VOA Zimbabwe Service has more from the provincial capital, Gweru.
Speaking at the commissioning of a new casualty department at Gweru Provincial Hospital today, Dr. David Parerenyatwa acknowledged the problems bedeviling the health sector, noting that the partnership would go a long way in revitalizing it. Dr. Parerenyatwa said the infrastructure at the hospital was once in a sorry state, and the upgrading of the department would ensure that it offers quality services to locals. He thanked the Anglo-American company, which through the firm's chairman's fund donated $1 million towards the construction of the casualty department, as well as the establishment of a visual inspection with acetic acid and cervicography unit, where women can undergo tests for cervical cancer.
It's not very encouraging. Now that you have a casualty like that, I think that we are going to be very, very proud and make sure that you actually train cadres in emergency medicine in a big way.
Speaking at the same occasion, former Midlands Governor Sifas Msipa, who addressed the gathering on behalf of Midlands Provincial Affairs Minister Jason Machaya, said it is not necessary for Zimbabweans to seek medical help outside the country, as local health personnel are equally competent and only need the necessary facilities and adequate remuneration to execute their duties. Msipa, a senior ZANU-PF member, revealed that he was recently hospitalized at a local hospital where he received quality treatment from dedicated medical practitioners. Member of Parliament for Gweru Urban, Cecil Rizai, who is also a member of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Health, said the establishment of the casualty department at Gweru Provincial Hospital through the help of a private company was a unique initiative which has to be emulated by other entities. Unki Mines board chairperson, July Ndlovu, who represented the parent Anglo-American company, said the funding of the casualty department is part of the company's focus to help uplift the communities in which it operates. Deputy Health Minister Dr. Paul Chimedza and senior health ministry officials also attended the event. Gweru Provincial Hospital has 350 beds and the new casualty department is capable of handling 40 patients. Reporting from Gweru, this is Taurai Shava.
Jeremiah Heaton traveled from his Virginia home to an unclaimed piece of land between Egypt and Sudan. He planted a flag there and named it the Kingdom of North Sudan. He insists that his young daughter, Emily, is now a princess. Viewer's Laura Bowman has more.
This is a playground in Virginia, not the grounds of a castle, but Emily Heaton is a princess. That's according to her dad, Jeremiah, who recently claimed one of the few unassigned pieces of land on the globe for little Emily.
With a child, you definitely don't want to ever tell them they can't be something that they desire to be. And at age six, her frame of reference for the world was to be a princess. And so I told her that she could be.
After doing some research, Heaton found that the territory known as Bir Tawil between Egypt and Sudan was not claimed by either country. So earlier this year, he went there and planted this flag he and his kids had designed. He says others have done it.
Recently, as the last 5 or 6 years, Russia went to the North Pole area and, using a submarine, planted a flag on the seafloor to represent their territorial claims for energy rights there. So the process of planting a flag is sort of the defined method of doing that.
Heaton seems serious about his plans for the kingdom he's calling North Sudan. He has rented an office in Washington as its embassy and says he expects to speak with representatives of Egypt and Sudan soon. Emily seems excited too.
We're going to help kids in Africa that don't have food, and we're going to build a garden as big as our land.
Despite Emily's royal appearance, experts in international law and politics are not optimistic about the new nation's survival. Edward Swain is a law professor at George Washington University.
At a basic level, he has to be correct in asserting that this is unclaimed land. That's not obvious to me that he's correct. Beyond that, he has to establish effective occupation of this land beyond simply planting a flag or showing up and taking a selfie.
We also spoke to Magdi Jazuli via Skype. He's a fellow with the Rift Valley Institute and an expert in Sudanese politics and history.
What if he tries to actually go there, develop a farm? What do you think those two countries would do? Will he be inviting conflict?
When he treads in, he will essentially invite the state to follow him, either to tax him or to get rid of him and to establish proper control.
Meantime, little Emily reigns in exile as her father tries to build a nation. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the British Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. Little-known 18-year-old Nigerian Ese Brume clinched a gold medal in the long jump with a leap of 6.56 metres on Thursday. Fellow Nigerian Blessing Okagbare added the 200-metre gold medal to her 100-metre title, while South African Cornel Fredericks won the 400-metre hurdles in 48.52 seconds. Nigel Amos won the 800 metres to hand Botswana their first medal of the Games. Kenyan David Lekuta Rudisha and South African Andre Olifir followed across the finish line, while sprinter Lehata Mosito improved his Lesotho 200-meter record to 20.36 seconds. Staying in Glasgow, South Africa are seventh on the medal table with 11 gold, 10 silver and 15 bronze medals. Nigeria is 8th, Kenya 10th, Cameroon 15th, Botswana 18th, Mozambique 25th, Namibia 30th, while Ghana, Mauritius, Uganda and Zambia share 31st spot among 36 nations and territories on the medal table. Turning to football, Seychelles has pulled out of the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers this coming weekend, the Confederation of African Football revealed in Cairo, Egypt on Thursday. They were due to host Sierra Leone in the return leg of their qualifier after losing the opening leg 2-0 in Freetown. Elsewhere, Malawi host Benin, Mauritania face Uganda, Guinea-Bissau play Botswana, and Rwanda face Congo-Brazzaville in other Nations Cup qualifiers tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, Kenya host Lesotho as Mozambique play Tanzania. In Ivory Coast, a Frenchman, Hervé Renard, is the new Ivory Coast national coach. The Ivory Coast Football Federation president, Augustin Sidi Diallo, revealed in Abidjan on Thursday. His first order of business is to qualify Ivory Coast for the Nations Cup in Morocco early next year. Meanwhile, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria welcomed the Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa Under-17 Championship qualifiers this weekend. Rwanda host Uganda, Gabon play Ethiopia, Morocco engage Guinea, South Africa welcome Tanzania, Ivory Coast face Libya, and Mali play Benin. Elsewhere, Botswana play Zambia, Burkina Faso engage Cameroon, Angola play Mozambique, while Republic of Congo face Egypt and Senegal host Togo. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you on Monday. Our listener mail for this Friday morning comes from Abdullahi Kabo of Freetown, Sierra Leone. He says, "Dear VOA, I felt extremely happy when I heard that the new people in charge at the Nigeria Football Association are bringing back one of the two people in football who have made Africa proud. I'm speaking about Stephen Keshi, the first African coach to take his national team to the level he did recently in Brazil. Let me also take the opportunity to thank the Ghanaians for keeping Kwesi Appiah. We thank you, Abdullahi Kabo of Freetown, Sierra Leone, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Friday, August 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.